William Henry is an investigative mythologist, author of numerous books on ancient mythology and neo-archaeology with a Stargate kind of twist. By applying the latest theories in science and consciousness to ancient myths of the gates of the illumined gods, including Sumerian, Egyptian, and Holy Grail gateway myths, he hopes to uncover the secrets guarded by such groups as the Illuminati. His latest DVD is called Stargate 2012, linking the Atlantis myth with modern wormhole theories, and states that we are on the verge of rediscovering the God's sacred science of uniting heaven and earth. And William, I hope we do the reuniting of heaven and earth sooner than later. How are you, my friend?
Ah, terrific, George. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Good. What have you been doing since we last chatted?
Oh, been busy. One of the big highlights of my summer, I went to France and had a wonderful tour with a group of Coptic folks from Michigan. It was a phenomenal time and got some really hardcore research done, which I'm really excited about.
What did you do in France? Now, but you had been there before for a trip, what, a year before that, right?
That's correct, yes. Thanks for remembering. Yeah. We did the usual tour going into Paris, Chartres Cathedral, on down to Rennes-le-Château, except on this trip we made a very special detour to a way-off-the-beaten-path village called Dom, which is a quote-unquote lost village in the Dordogne Valley that practically no one's ever heard of, but there were some researchers in the 80s named Ayan and Dyke Begg who had written a book called In Search of the Holy Grail and the Precious Blood, and they described this kind of bizarre graffiti found in the chateau at Dom where Knights Templar had been imprisoned during their surprise attack in 1307. And this graffiti portrayed a really unusual set of symbols. It showed a pregnant woman holding a rod or a wand. It showed a crucifixion scene, and that's all I knew, and I had never seen a photo of it, and so I was really dying to get there. It's like, imagine, you know, what are we talking about here? A pregnant woman holding a rod or wand at the crucifixion.
And knowing you, you've got to see these pictures, because I know the way you hunt for those.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that you really learn right off the bat, is that very often if you're in a book and you see an image, you want to know what's on the left of it, the right of it, above it, below it, because that's what really tells the whole story. So I had been imagining this, what this graffiti might have looked like. And then when I got there, I was just absolutely flabbergasted to see that these Templars had inscribed within the stone a perfect Sephirotic tree of life, the Kabbalistic tree of life. This is really important because you have numerous researchers that say that the Templars had all kinds of Gnostic knowledge, or they had this knowledge that the Illuminati had been seeking or been preserving, and it is what enabled them to become the advanced beings that many purport them to have been. But you never see direct evidence of it. You never see it in any of the Templar books or anything. Well, here it is. And by the way, my analysis of this Templar graffiti at Dom is made the cover story of Atlantis Rising this month. People can, Coast listeners can download it for free at atlantisrising.com, or I've got it on the front page of my site, williamhenry.net. And you can see this amazing imagery because, and it gets even more amazing than that, because in addition to this tree of life that clearly indicates that they possessed this ancient Jewish mystic knowledge, we also see, and this is so wild, what we see is an image that almost precisely matches the Dagon tribe's landing of the craft of a figure they called Namo, which was this sort of fish god that matches so many other fish gods throughout the ancient world.
Well, they're the ones who believe some extraterrestrials came down from the Sirius star system, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what in the world is this doing accompanying this crucifixion imagery at Dom, and what are the Knights Templar doing exemplifying that in their artwork here? And it's the start of a new path of Templar research here, because we know that the Templars were in Jerusalem, we know that they were likely in Egypt, but we didn't know that they were mixing with the Dagon tribe or that they had assimilated some of their beliefs yet. Here it is in their symbolism that they etched onto the wall of this chateau.
That story of the Dagon tribe is, to me, one of the most remarkable stories I've ever heard, William, in terms of how they had knowledge of a star system that you couldn't see with the naked eye. And, I mean, it was just incredible with what they were able to do.
Oh, it was such purity, too. And whenever I talk about the Dagon tribe, I have to mention there's an author named Laird Scranton who has a book called Hidden Meanings, which is a study of the Dagon symbolism. And he's an author that John Anthony West has been working with and carefully shepherding. And you'll be hearing from Laird soon, I'm sure, because his book is just absolutely astounding in his analysis of the Dagon tribe and linking it with modern science. So I hope that we...
Well, I want him, so you get him for me, okay?
Okay. I'll do it.
We'll turn you... Hey, when I found out that you were doing work on Atlantis, I mean, I was just thrilled to death because that is one subject I just can't get enough of. Tell me a little bit about your overview, first of all, and your interest with Atlantis.
Well, of course, it's the end and the beginning of all myths, in a sense. I mean, all roads seem to lead to Atlantis, or to what we call the New Atlantis in terms of prophecy. And it's just such an alluring story because it has so many gaps in it, but yet it has so many clues to something magnificent that went on in the ancient world. I mean, and if I were giving you the Hollywood pitch on this story, it would be the story of a high civilization founded by the gods who came to Earth, who mated with humankind, and built a temple enclosure, in fact, a shrine for the offspring of the gods. But then through the course of time, this divine essence that the gods possessed was diluted, and the civilization fell and suffered a cataclysm. And now the third act of this story is the long march to reclaim this once advanced civilization and allow humankind to once again dwell in what we call the New Atlantis, or what's referred to in the Bible as the New Jerusalem.
Yeah, sounds a little like Plato, too, doesn't it?
Well, that's where the story originated, was with Plato in 400 B.C., exactly.
What did he know? How did he know? Did this come from myth? Did it come from stories handed down from father to son or mother to daughter? How did Plato hold on to this? And did anybody else write about Atlantis afterward, William, or was it just Plato?
Well, actually, yes, a lot of people did write about Atlantis, including the Aztecs and the Mayas. They called it Aztlan or Atlan or its sacred name Tula, which is a word we can talk about in a moment. But to answer your question, Plato received the story from Egypt. It's claimed that he was initiated in the great mysteries of Egypt at the age of 49. And this is kind of the style of the way the Atlantis story is presented. It simply says that he was initiated in these mysteries of Egypt, although it does not say exactly what those mysteries were. It's sort of like the way we're told that Moses was trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And I guess we're supposed to fill in with our imagination and suggest that that means he knows who built the Sphinx and why, who built the Great Pyramids and how, and all of the other matters about the temples of ancient Egypt.
I guess if other civilizations have mentioned Atlantis in either a direct or roundabout way, one has to assume that something happened to a highly advanced civilization. Exactly what, of course, we can debate, but to me it sounds like some kind of Earth calamity, but that this region, wherever it may be, truly existed. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it's my belief that our ability to grasp the importance of the Atlantis myths at current events is only matched by our ability to absorb the astounding when we think of the ancient world, that how advanced do we want to make this civilization? We're talking about a civilization founded by the quote-unquote gods who were in contact with a wisdom center at the center of the universe, where in the Atlantis story, the god Zeus dwelled. Now, I'm of a belief and of an axis of researchers that really was inspired by Dr. Paula Violette that believes that the center of the universe referred to in Plato's story is, in fact, the center of our galaxy, the center of the Milky Way. And so it suggests that we have a civilization here on Earth where advanced beings dwelled, who were also in contact with a wisdom center, another wisdom center at the center of our Milky Way.
And how was that communication? Do we know?
Well, no, we don't know for certain, although Plato does give us a clue in that humankind, the offspring, rather, of the mating of the gods and humans, the hybrid humans, were inspired, if you will, through what appears to me to sound like mental telepathy in Plato's account. And so it suggests that there was some kind of a telepathic link, a form of consciousness that united perhaps Earth with the galactic center, but which certainly united the people of Earth. And it's through this telepathic mental communication that they were able to stay in contact with one another.
The Bible, of course, has some tremendous clues of a lot of different things. Is there anything in there that would lead you to believe that Atlantis was put in the Bible?
Well, when the race of Atlanteans lost their quote-unquote divine essence, this is what brought about the wrath of the god Zeus, and this is what triggered the cataclysm of Atlantis. So it appears to have been a premeditated cataclysm. There was foreknowledge that it was going to occur. But to answer your question here, this wrath of Zeus equates with the reasons given in the book of Genesis for God sending Noah's flood upon mankind. We had simply gone too far off the path. Our divine essence had been diluted. And as a consequence, it was time for a cleansing to occur. Now, it's not just the Bible that refers to this cataclysm and the divine essence. There's another set of books called the Gnostic text from the early 2nd to 4th century. And in that collection of books, there's one particular text called the Hypostasis of the Archons, which is also called the Reality of the Rulers. And in that book, it also describes a group of beings called Archons who seek to possess this divine essence that's within humankind. They don't have it. We do. They want to take it from us. And the crazy thing about this is that these Archons resemble what we would today call the Greys, extraterrestrial race. Yes.
That's a great story. And all of that is laid out in ancient mythology or ancient texts.
Yes, that story I just described about the Archons is in this early Gnostic Christian text called the Hypostasis of the Archons. I wrote about it in my book, Oracle of the Illuminati, and I even put pictures in there that I downloaded from the Baghdad Museum of what we think these Archons look like, and they are clearly some form of, they look just like Greys, George.
Could they be the vivid imagination of the author of the day?
They very well could be. I mean, there's no question that when we're talking about Atlantis, we're talking about a creation myth, just like the book of Genesis is a creation myth. And in that sense, we are definitely talking about the possibility of this simply being a story that is susceptible to many levels of interpretation, including the historical, but especially the metaphorical and the allegorical. To use a modern word, Atlantis is what we call a meme, spelled M-E-M-E, meme, which is a catch-all phrase for a code symbol. America is a meme. America is a place name, but it's also a mental program, a matrix or a realm of possibility, as well as a spiritual goal. And that's exactly what the word or meme Atlantis is. It's a program, a realm of possibility, as well as a spiritual goal.
The Bible writes about Noah's flood.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the dates, you know, Noah's flood being, 5,000 B.C., something like that?
Give or take a few, yeah.
Give or take a few. Is it possible that we may be talking about the same thing, Noah's flood that's in the Bible, the sinking of Atlantis, which may have occurred from an asteroid or who knows what? Is it possible that these are the same stories?
Well, it's quite possible, too, but we have to remind ourselves that Plato actually claimed that there had been several cataclysms throughout the past. And he says exactly that, coming from his ancestor, that the Greeks are all children, and you have no belief rooted in old tradition. And the reason is this, is because there have been and will be many different calamities to destroy mankind, the greatest of them by fire and by water.
Well, let's talk about what might have happened to Atlantis, William. Based on your research, what's your best guess?
My best guess is based upon, again, the research of Dr. Paula Violette, that a cyclical event destroys humankind through a terrible cataclysm. It's called a galactic superwave, which is La Violette's term for an intense volley of cosmic rays that come from the center of our galaxy when it explodes periodically. And what we find when this happens, we have the arrival of an electromagnetic pulse and later a gravity wave that triggers tsunamis, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. And also, and here's the real crux of our contemporary time, it also triggers problems with the sun. And I've been following, for example, the newsletter put out by Mitch Batros, the Earth Changes TV newsletter, he's documenting in a very almost frightening way the problems that we're having with the sun right now, and that it's quite possible that Hurricane Katrina and the intense volley of hurricanes we've had the past year are coming from problems from the sun, but that originates from, in La Violette's model, from a galactic superwave event emanating from the center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Well, you know, you may be right, William, because something is heating up these oceans, whether they're underground volcanoes, global warming, or it's a cycle, but it could very well be something from the sun as well.
Well, and the BBC News just put out a report yesterday that global warming is currently happening on Mars, too.
Yeah.
NASA reported that the deposits of frozen carbon dioxide near the planet's South Pole have shrunk three summers in a row.
They've had some gullies that have just occurred, they said.
Yeah.
They were not there several years ago.
Right. And so these changes suggest that climate change is happening now on Mars.
Well, these Atlanteans, as their continent was sinking, as the landmass was sinking, they fled. They escaped, didn't they, some of them?
Yes.
Where'd they go?
Central Asia. They went to portions of South America, we are told. At least this is where they re-inhabited their civilization. There's wonderful research being done by folks like Greg Little down in the Yucatan that are right on the edge of finding what they think is a Yucatan Hall of Records prophesied by Edgar Cayce, and lo and behold, there it is. So those are two primary locations. I'm focusing a lot of my attention on the Central Asia region, especially Mongolia, a region that is called by the mystic name Shambhala. Spent a lot of years researching a figure named Nicholas Rurik, who went in search of the secrets of the Holy Grail in Shambhala, because it is claimed that a hidden directorate that operates behind the scenes of humanity operates from Shambhala in Central Asia, and their lineage is traced all the way back to Atlantis. And so that's a very key bit of research right there for me.
All right, William's website, by the way, is williamhenry.net. Okay, williamhenry.net. And we'll be back in a moment with William Henry. He's got a very fascinating story about Cherokee Indian mythology. We'll talk about that as we search for Atlantis. And also, next hour, if you have a computer, get ready to look at some of these images that William has supplied us, and we're going to go through them next hour. Tell us a little bit about this Cherokee Indian. Was it a mythology? Was it a real story about what they talked about the extraterrestrials?
Right. I'm recounting a Cherokee Indian creation mythology that was documented by Diani Wehu in her book Voices of Our Ancestors. She's a 27th generation Cherokee Indian storyteller. And so what we're being told is that this story that we're about to discuss has been passed along for 27 generations, excuse me, and it was kept secret until 1969 when we landed on the moon. And the essential story is that the Cherokee believed that they were created by beings of light called TLA beings, which stands for a word called Tula, an ancient name for Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
These beings of light came from the Pleiades through what may be described as a vortex or a hole in space over East Tennessee, Oak Ridge area, where we built the world's first nuclear reactor. And there they created the Cherokee to guard one of 12 gates of energy that surround the planet.
In your research, William, how prevalent is extraterrestrial life as opposed to dimensional life? You know, we've talked about the stargates and the wormholes and things like that. Are we talking about two separate things, or are they all tied together?
I think they're all tied together, George, because while we see gods, and I go into this in detail in my DVD, Stargates of the Gods and Stargate 2012,
right.
I have a whole catalog of images from the ancient world that portray gods flying in craft. And I prefer to call them craft because the description of them is this, that shows the gods in a ring that has wings. And when we look at this, our knee-jerk reaction is to say, oh, well, this is these are the chariots of the gods. This is Eric von Däniken's UFOs. But then when we look into the stories that accompany such imagery, we find out that the gods aren't, in fact, flying in craft. They're in what are called Merkaba vehicles, space-time light vehicles that have more of an interdimensional quality. In addition to that, these gods, some of them have a chakra or a ring in their hand. So not only are they flying within a ring that is winged, but they have a ring in their hand, and that ring is called the Ring of Cosmic Sovereignty. And what that says to me is that these beings are free to come and go and travel anywhere that they like. And the way that they do this is through these interdimensional vehicles that transport them through gateways.
Now, the Tula, that ancient name for Atlantis that you just mentioned, it had some effect on you too, did it?
It did. I mean, it's my magic word, I call it. I first encountered it back in 1990. I was at that time. It's trying to get my writing career going, and I had been doing research for a gentleman, reading books for a living for him, and then that job ended, and next thing I know, here comes Ted Turner, founder of CNN, with a literary contest. He said that science and technology can't solve the world's problems, and he offered $500,000 for the best piece of fiction that discusses themes for the survival and prosperity of all life on the planet. And so I was researching and doing a fictional work for that contest, which I entered. And by the way, so did James Redfield. He entered the Celestine Prophecy. He didn't win either. But what I found is, or what my proposal was, is that if we're going to make any difference in this world, we have to start with the children. We have to begin to re-educate them or allow them to show us a way to build this ideal civilization. So I had created a place that was shaped like an egg with butterfly wings and a heart-shaped head, thinking that those three symbols, the egg, the wings, and the heart, would best exemplify it, an advanced kind of civilization these children could build. And I needed a name for the place. And one night I had gone to see Randy Winter's video presentation on the Pleiadians, in which he showed those amazing photographs that Billy Meyer was supposed to have taken in Switzerland of the Pleiadian beam craft, which are astounding, right? And I remember driving home after that event, looking up at the stars, and for the first time saying, well, wait a minute, these lights that I see in the blackness of space, those aren't two-dimensional lights. There's three-dimensional space beyond that. And it was a really kind of mind-expanding moment. So I got home that night, and I stood on my back porch, and I said, okay, you know, Pleiadians, if you guys are real and you're communicating with us, give me a name for my my academy for these kids. And the word Tula popped into my mind.
And there it was.
And there it was. And I thought I had made the name up, like Haagen-Dazs or Sony, and thought it was something new. And so I enter the contest, and of course I don't win. And but then I start doing research.
Did you get a letter from them? Anything?
No, nothing.
Nothing.
Oh, in fact, it was kind of a bummer at the end of it, because William Styron was one of the judges, so was Ray Bradbury. And they both said that the book that won didn't deserve to win. So I'm thinking, well, if you guys were the judges and you're saying the book that won didn't deserve to win, something's wrong here.
We know Bradbury. We should send him one of your books and say, what do you think of this guy?
Yeah. So to finish the story, I just started doing research and found out that Tula actually existed in the ancient world. It was the most sacred name for Atlantis. It was the name of the center of Atlantis. And in fact, the Druids claimed it's the name of the center of the galaxy.
That's interesting. The technology that was on Atlantis must have been absolutely astounding.
Well, we would think so, absolutely. And the reason that we can claim that is by the symbols of the technology that's been left behind and passed down through the generations.
And what are the odds, though, William, of an area that may have been the most technologically advanced ever, maybe even more so than us today, and that area goes, in all these other regions, nothing happened to them? I mean, isn't that strange all by itself?
Very. Very definitely. And then I also find it kind of interesting that many, for example, people believe that the Atlanteans then went into Egypt. Well, a lot of Egyptologists reject that notion, and in fact, you find many traditions rejecting the Atlantean concept. So that's kind of interesting, too.
Do you think they did, that they went into Egypt?
I don't have direct evidence. I'm going back to Egypt in March of 2006 with Freddie Silva, and I've got some research to follow up on in terms of following the trail that we're talking about tonight. So maybe I'll have some new information about that next year.
I mean, there's just no question that the technology of the Egyptians, of the Central Americans, the Incas, the Mayans, there's got to be some shared technology here. They may have been all part of the same people.
Quite possibly, and are definitely drawing from the same wisdom well, because we see so many of the same symbols appearing over and over again, and that to me is the way that we can track the continuation of the Atlantean meme, if you will.
You know, after the tsunami December 26th and then what Hurricane Katrina did to New Orleans, I sometimes try to sit back and picture what it would have been like to be on Atlantis when whatever happened to them occurred. I think it was fast. And then, of course, thousands of years later, they got hit with more. And then the whole thing submerged. But I think, you know, just by watching the tsunami, watching Hurricane Katrina, we might have been witnesses to what happened to Atlantis.
That's exactly right. And that's why I wanted to come on and share this moment with you here, because it does give us this rare opportunity, a horrifying glimpse of what the awesome destruction of Atlantis must have looked like. And, you know, again, We have this image that Atlantis disappeared in a single day and night. But then you have others that came along. For example, Francis Bacon says that, no, it actually took almost 100 years for the demise of the civilization. And so, gosh, you know, take your pick. Would you rather go down in one night or a very slow cataclysm that takes many decades? And unfortunately, it looks like that's the direction we're headed in, unless we can take some steps to forestall that cataclysm.
You know, I'd want to go down in a slow way, and I'll tell you why, William. To me, there's always hope, and there's always this positiveness that you could surround yourself with, and that you can always fight. And if something happens so swiftly, you never had a chance, that would be disappointing. But if we have time to fight the ills that are out there, whatever they may be, that's the direction I'd like to go.
Well, I agree. And in fact, that's the kind of the opportunity that we have here. This is, I believe, truly a golden moment for humanity. because we have a chance right now to make permanent a new state of consciousness that you might, that the alchemists called the Philosopher's Stone, that has other names, but what it starts with is a marriage of the opposites. And that's our problem. One of our main problems right now is the opposites in our world, the imbalance between rich and poor, especially. I mean, the UN used to give numbers a couple of years ago that over half the world's population doesn't have a toilet and is 2.5 days walk from the nearest telephone.
You know what? We take these things for granted, don't we?
Absolutely. And that imbalance is what has to be healed. And in my view, the only way we heal that is we have to bring in a third higher force that balances the two. It's a new spiritual energy as well as a desire that has to come into this world. And, you know, I also believe we have the technology, George, because you have so many people talking about, well, you know, the Hurricane Katrina and perhaps even the tsunami is an example of a secret weather war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we have the ability to control a hurricane, which is hundreds of times more powerful than a hydrogen bomb, then we are classified as what Michio Kaku would call a type one civilization. That means that we have the capability, the technology to solve all our problems. What we lack at present is the motivation to use this technology for peaceful purpose. And that's why I say we're on the verge of rediscovering the God's sacred science of uniting heaven and earth, because again, a civilization that has tapped its resources but does not have the technology to control its planetary resources and still derives its energy from fossil fuels and coal is going nowhere. But a type one civilization that can control the energy resources of its planet and can control the weather, as is being proposed right now, can prevent earthquakes, can harvest the oceans, can explore its solar system, and is on the verge of becoming a civilization that we would call actually advanced.
Well, I'm here, of course, in St. Louis. You are in Nashville, right?
Yes.
And then, of course, we've got this New Orleans connection. But you talk about some kind of prophecy that relates to these three cities.
Yes. In the Keys of Enoch, Dr. J.J. Hertog describes new cities of light that are going to emerge at the time of the millennium right now. And he calls this the anointing of the dove, or an area, a region called the dove, that is laid over the United States. The central axis of this complex goes right, begins through the Yucatan, goes straight through New Orleans and straight up through St. Louis. You can virtually draw a line on Interstate 55,
mm-hmm.
and that becomes the central axis of this dove region. And in the book, which is a prophecy given to him by Enoch, the biblical figure who ascended to the heavens in a whirlwind and walked with the gods, he claims that Nashville, Tennessee is going to be one of the primary repositories of light. Now, this is a place where we're going to see advanced knowledge emerge, perhaps even advanced knowledge that was one time prevalent within Atlantis or other high advanced civilizations. And lo and behold, what we have in St. Louis is Cahokia Mound,
yes.
which is a very special place. And here in Nashville, we've got a duplicate of the Parthenon from ancient Greece, and we've also got a 2,200-foot-long magician's rod that is laid out at the base of our state capitol.
They are still finding things at Cahokia Mounds right now that they never knew existed. Much more than, you know, originally they thought it was just a mound of, you know, an Indian burial ground or a place of worship, and it was just all dirt, you know, piled high. Now they're beginning to see structures within it with the kind of machinery and technology that they have. I think if they ever really investigate it, William, they may find some secrets there.
Oh, I definitely think so, and I'm taking a cue on this from Thomas Jefferson, who was deeply, deeply interested in the mounds of ancient America. We call them mounds because you can't say the word pyramid in America, but that's what the Cahokia Mound is. It's a pyramid whose base is larger than the Great Pyramid of Giza. And so what we have here is an ancient civilization that inhabited these regions, Nashville, St. Louis, and even down into the Louisiana, New Orleans region. And it's the records are still there. The knowledge of those civilizations is still there. And I've been making a study of the symbols of what they call them, the Mississippian people, the Mississippian era. When we go into the Tennessee State Museum here in Nashville, they have examples of their plates, their pottery. Their symbols that we see on this pottery, it's all Anunnaki symbols. You can't tell the difference between the stuff that's on the plates here in Nashville and the stuff they're pulling out of the ground in Iraq.
I know. That is strange. It really is. When we come back at the top of the hour, William, let's go through some of the pictures and graphics that you sent us, okay? And then I'll have you explain what they are.
Love to. Thank you, George.
Now, who created them? Was that Dana? Did Dana do that?
Yes. Dana Augustine created the image we call the New Atlantis that's on the coast-to-coast site as the masthead. And a couple others are actually several hundred years old. And I've got another piece of art done by Jack Andrews from Tucson, Arizona, that's quite remarkable as well.
Okay, we're going to look at seven plates, at least initially.
Great.
Called Atlantis Plate 1 through 7, and we'll have William explain what they are because they have a lot to do with his presentation today. And I'm telling you, you look at these pictures, you can see wormholes and everything else. I mean, they knew something a long time ago, didn't they? Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with William Henry. William, tell me a little bit about symbols as it relates to Atlantis, and why is it important?
Well, the symbols are a way that we transmit knowledge. It's sort of like the way a symbol works is you have, if you're using an analogy with a computer, you have a logo on your computer screen. And it might say, for example, it might have a W, which stands for Microsoft Word. And when you click on that symbol on your computer screen, there magically appears behind it this whole capability of performing a task. And that's the way I view sacred symbols as well, such as the symbol for Atlantis, which is the concentric rings with a cross in the center. When we click on that symbol and are able to access the tremendous knowledge behind it, it gives us the capability of performing the task that is inherent within that symbol. And in this particular case, what the symbol of Atlantis represents is, on the deepest esoteric level, it represents the transformation of our chaotic self into our divine self that is our birthright.
Okay, let's go through these symbols that you supplied us. Plate one, if you have a computer. If not, William, would you please describe what it looks like for people who don't have the luxury of looking at these? And then just tell us what they mean.
Yeah, it'll be my pleasure. And before I do that, George, can I send all best wishes to Victoria Jack?
Yes, you sure can. I mentioned that last week, too. How's she doing?
Well, I just talked with Tom. I just heard the news that Victoria, who
heads up the UFO Expo.
Yes, the Bay Area UFO Expo is not doing so well, and so I just wanted to send her all best wishes and know that everybody has her in her thoughts and prayers here.
So, okay, that's great. Thank
yeah.
you.
The first symbol that we're looking at in Plate 1, again, we're seeing a comparison of the concentric rings of Atlantis, which shows three concentric rings with a cross in the center. This is called the bullseye. And this is the logo for Atlantis. This ring and cross symbol is literally derived from Plato's description of the enclosure built by the gods to protect the original sacred hill of Atlantis. Now, something that's very important about this symbol to note is this. Jordan Maxwell is one of the preeminent symbolists that we have, and he describes a symbol as a sign. A sign or a symbol indicates direction, like stop or go this way, or it can inform one of ownership. And in a sense, because this enclosure of Atlantis was built by the gods to protect the hybrid gods and humans, it was designed also to keep another set of humans out of Atlantis.
There is meaning behind these symbols.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yes. Yeah, and this is the meaning of it. The meaning of the Atlantis symbol is this place belongs to the gods. Humans keep out. is essentially what it says. But we have to ask the question then, what is this saying that humans are to keep away from? And the answer is provided, I believe, by the NASA image that I have also on plate one, which shows an image of a warp craft, which is a term that they borrowed from Star Trek. It shows a craft entering a wormhole that is depicted as concentric rings, just like the symbol of Atlantis. But what we see here is that the two-dimensional image of the rings, the concentric rings, actually symbolizes a three-dimensional experience, the experience of going through a gateway. Now, in the language of symbolism, whenever you see that the two-dimensional image of the concentric rings, we're allowed to then apply this imagery to it, this meaning to it, and what it indicates is that when we see the 2D image of Atlantis, the concentric rings, it represents a 3D experience of the gateway, and that means that what the gods were ultimately protecting was a gateway.
Okay, see, and I see what you're doing here, too, is you're giving us an image of something modern today, like this NASA image.
Yes.
And then you're comparing it to the ancient image to see the correlation.
That's right, because literally, George, the three-dimensional perspective was not rediscovered, if you will, until Da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper during the Renaissance. So it's only been within the past 400 years that we have this three-dimensional perspective in artwork. Here, before that, everything was two-dimensional, and we had to extrapolate with our imagination that when we see the 2D image, it's actually representing a three-dimensional experience.
So you're saying, though, that they knew back then of either wormholes or black holes, right?
That's exactly right. And in fact, again, to riff on the work of Dr. Paula Violette, he also uses this same imagery that I'm presenting tonight, the logo of Atlantis, to suggest that it's not necessarily the gateway that I present, although it could be. He's saying that represents the ultimate science of subatomic particles. So we have very sound scientific reasons for believing that this imagery is in fact encoding advanced scientific knowledge.
Now, how did they know this then, back thousands and thousands of years ago?
Well, if we operate from the premise that Plato was operating from, this symbolism would have been telepathically communicated to humanity by the gods themselves. Now, that god in particular would be Poseidon in the Atlantis story. It also involves the god Zeus, who is at the center of the Milky Way galaxy and the wisdom center there. We know them perhaps better as the Anunnaki gods, Enki and Enlil, because those two Sumerian gods are simply retooled versions of Poseidon and Zeus are retooled versions of the original Sumerian gods.
But extraterrestrials.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There you go. Yes. Let's call them Anunnaki, which is a very broad term for beings who came to Earth from the heavens.
What's remarkable, William, as various civilizations talk about the same thing. How could they be wrong?
Well, that's right. And I think what we're looking at here is that analogy of a mirror that was shattered. And various cultures pick up a piece of that mirror in the form of symbols and say, aha, here is the whole truth. But in fact, what they have is a piece of the whole truth. And that's what I believe we're looking at with this imagery that we're exploring tonight, is pieces of the whole truth.
All right, let's go to plate number two. What are we looking at here?
Plate number two is what it portrays is an hourglass shape that is a design that came from 1882 in Japan, and it portrays the world pillar called Meru, which is the name of the center of Atlantis. Meru is also called the Holy Mountain. It's the glorious shining peak that one encounters in virtually every culture, and we find it in essentially all religions and sacred traditions concerning paradise. In fact, we're told that that the people of Atlantis were called the people of Meru after this world pillar. And when you compare the hourglass shape of the world pillar that came down through this Buddhist drawing with a modern depiction of a wormhole, we have a near-perfect match.
Why do they seem to be so fascinated with wormholes?
Well, because, in my view, the story of the Gate of the Gods is the ultimate myth, going back to the story of the Garden of Eden, which, again, compares quite nicely with the Atlantis story. Humankind at one time lived in a paradisical realm, but then through some form of a transgression, either the dilution of our divine essence in the Atlantis story or because Eve ate or received the forbidden knowledge, we were evicted from that paradise. And in the Garden of Eden story in the book of Genesis, after the Old Testament God Yahweh evicted us from the garden, He placed cherubim on either side of the gate of Eden and placed a flaming sword in that gate in order to protect it. That's exactly the Atlantis story. That is exactly what the gods did in building this enclosure of Atlantis, symbolized by the concentric rings with the cross in the center. And from that time forward, it has been humankind's quest to reclaim that gate, to actually be able to re-enter that paradisical realm. And in my view, what that is, ultimately, is our ascension into, again, Michio Kaku's Type 2 civilization, a civilization that uses the power of the sun to supply its enormous energy needs, colonizes our local star system, and then eventually is able to control the power of an entire galaxy and manipulate space-time to become time travelers.
The television show Stargate, which is on Sci-Fi, which takes a lot of these things, William, and then illustrates them, of course, with some pretty interesting television, has been a very successful show for the Sci-Fi Network for years, primarily because of the interest in this.
Absolutely. I don't watch Stargate or Stargate Atlantis, although I would love to talk with the writers of that show and show them some of this imagery, because what they're describing here is not necessarily science fiction. I mean, according to this imagery here, this knowledge has been floating around in the consciousness of humanity for a very long time, and we are now coming into a position here in this golden moment, as I call it, where we can assemble this capability and literally transform our species.
Plate number three I find very fascinating because it talks about the collapse of that world pillar. Explain these plates.
This one is mind-blowing, isn't it? Because what we see are primarily two figures. There's one that's holding a sheet that is preparing to cover the collapse of the world pillar, Meru, again in the shape of the hourglass figure. In this image as well, it shows, it has, of course, the concentric rings symbol as well, but it shows the collapse of Meru, and coming from it appear to be these sort of curious crystal-type things that may represent other dimensions. And what it says to me is that Meru is or was a wormhole, a gateway that was open, but then it collapsed. Suddenly, the civilization collapsed, which is what happened to Atlantis. And it suggests to me that the submersion of Atlantis has more to do with the collapse of a gateway into the heavens, vis-a-vis perhaps some cataclysm or some premeditated act, perhaps even an act of warfare by the gods against humankind. Either way, this wormhole, this gateway to the stars, collapsed. And what I'm showing in plate three here is that the way that the Buddhists portrayed the collapse of Meru perfectly matches the way modern science portrays the collapse of a wormhole.
Well, that's true. And the way you've got it illustrated points that out.
Yeah, so it's, again, suggesting, showing the complete story here that this gateway existed, but then through some cataclysmic event, the gateway collapsed, and once again we find ourselves on the long march to reclaim the secrets of this gate.
All right, now plate number four is a wild-looking thing. Tell what the heck are we looking at here?
That's, that it is a wild-looking thing. What we're looking at is a drawing from a second-century Chinese manuscript of Mount Meru, which, again, is the name of the center of Atlantis. And it looks, at first glance, like we're looking at some kind of an antenna.
And yes.
In fact, that's what Mongolian myth says this thing is, that the
or it looks like one of those things, William, from those old sci-fi movies, you know, like a pulse machine or something like that, and those coils would all light up in those real early sci-fi flicks.
Yeah, very good, George, because actually I was in Florida giving a lecture on this subject a few years ago, and a scientist came up to me after my talk, and he said, "Hey, I was basically asleep through your presentation until you put up that blueprint." And I said, "What blueprint?"
Yeah, really.
And he went through my slides until he came to this very drawing that we're looking at right now, and he said, "I designed particle beam weapons for a living, you know, Star Wars-type weapons."
Mm-hmm.
So what you're looking at there is a blueprint for a particle beam weapon.
That's interesting. I was going to say something like that. It's some kind of accelerator or weapon.
That's what it is. It's a particle accelerator. And the question is, what is a blueprint for a particle accelerator doing in a second century Chinese manuscript?
How did it get there?
And how did it get there? It was found in what is called a cache called the Dunhuang or Tunhuang manuscripts, which is a sort of Buddhist hall of records that was discovered in the early 1900s. And I was just came upon it by chance in a book on the sacred mountains of Asia, and that was a number of years ago. That was 1999, and I've spent the interim trying to understand this device. And the amazing thing is that this is a diagram of Meru. It is unquestionably a diagram of some kind of a pulse weapon or a particle accelerator, a device that that advanced theoretical physicists proposed could be used to build, we could build a giant space-based particle accelerator to open stargates and wormholes.
If they were able to have that technology, somebody obviously gave it to them, or we're dealing with a civilization that was extremely advanced, and we somehow lost for years that kind of know-how and technology.
Well, that is the proposal that, you know, building on the works of Zachariah Sitchin, who said that the Anunnaki, when they came here, were at least 3,000 years in advance, technologically speaking, of where we're at today.
And so At least.
And so, again, to refer to Michio Kaku, he proposes it's going to take us about 1,000 years to be powerful enough to control the power of our entire galaxy and to become time travelers. But maybe they already had that capability long ago. And that's the suggestion that I'm making here, and we'll talk about as we continue, that the Anunnaki did not come here in rocket-powered ships, as Sitchin proposes. He was looking at it from the lens of the mid-70s. Looking at it from the lens of the early 21st century, we can clearly see that this device is what would be required for time travel. And perhaps the Anunnaki are the ones responsible for bringing this device here. And if that's so, they traveled the galaxy as time travelers in warp craft.
Plate 5, similar to Plate 4?
Plate 5, yes. I took that scientist challenge in Florida. He said, you know, look, you're dealing with a particle accelerator here. So I did some digging, and I was able to find one of the first particle accelerators that was designed by Ernesto Livermore in the early 1920s, and it was used in atom-smashing experiments. And I show a comparison here of this particle accelerator designed by Livermore with the second-century Chinese drawing, and they're a virtual match as well.
I got to tell you, the graphic that you supplied for the plate, to me, if you're looking at it, William, right on the right-hand side, it looks like some small creature standing by it. Do you see, like, it looks like two eyes and a mouth?
Yes, isn't that interesting? Yes, very interesting.
Two arms and two legs. Look at it.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. In fact, that the base of this construction, in fact, is a virtual ringer for a uterus as well, which is maybe why you're picking up on that human imagery there. You know, this is just amazing stuff, and I have been working with the second century drawing for a few years, and then just last year I came in contact with an artist named Jack Andrews, who had a real Central Asian feel to his artwork, and asked him to render this in 3D, and that's the imagery that we're looking at here. And we can see that when we take this two-dimensional drawing and insert it into a 3D computer program, it brings it to life in a truly remarkable way.
When we come back, William, we'll look at plates 6 and 7. 7 will blow your mind, everybody. And I'm beginning to wonder if, for example, the Bermuda Triangle might be some kind of stargate or portal. Who knows? We'll ask William that question when we come back. William, we'll go to plate 6 and then 7 and many questions about these portals and wormholes and stargates. But explain plate 6 for us, if you would.
What we're looking at now is a drawing that was etched onto a gold plate that was presented to King Tutankhamun by Nubian goldsmiths in around 1400 BC. And this is the image that is one of the centerpieces of Zachariah Sitchin's books. He proposes that what we're looking at here is an Anunnaki Shem craft, an Anunnaki spacecraft, a rocket ship sitting on top of a missile silo. And that's, you know, quite a, you know, an interesting proposition there. In fact, I was in Memphis giving a talk to a Mensa Society group one night about this, and I put this up and said, this is, you know, Zachariah Sitchin proposes this is a rocket ship. And one of the geniuses in the crowd said, oh, that's not a rocket ship, that's a snow cone. It does look like a snow cone, to be honest. And so,
I don't know. It does look like an Apollo capsule.
It does. It absolutely does. So somewhere in between a snow cone and Apollo capsule may be what we're looking at here. But, again, getting back to our drawing or depiction from the second century of this Meru particle accelerator, we see at the apex of that drawing a triangular apex. And when I work with artists such as Jack Andrews or with Dana Augustine, I always try to withhold information. I don't even tell them sometimes what we're actually working on. And that was the experience that Jack had. He's like, I don't know what this thing is, but it's blowing my mind. And what it ended up showing to us is that at the apex of this Meru drawing was, in fact, some form of a cone-shaped craft that appeared to be ejected from the particle accelerator at the very base of this pillar. And this is where I started really hypothesizing that what we're actually looking at here in Sitchin's drawing from the Nubian goldsmiths, as well as from this second century Meru drawing, is actually some form of a warp craft, again, to use NASA's term borrowed from Star Trek, that is ejected or travels through these gateways.
What if it's a missile silo, William? I mean, you know, there has been talk that we've had past nuclear disasters on this planet, maybe from high sophisticated ancient civilizations. What if this is a missile?
Well, it could be a missile, George, save for the fact that in particular here in this this Nubian depiction presented to Tutankhamun, underneath the ground we see two figures that have their backs turned to a pillar in between the two of them. And the pillar that they stand in between is the pillar of Osiris, which, according to Egyptian myth and religion, is the symbol for resurrection and ascension. So in this particular instance, it's likely that we're not looking at some form of a weapon system. Rather, we're looking at some form of a spiritual technology, and that this craft that is portrayed on the top of the ground here has something to do with ascension and resurrection, which is essentially stepping into higher dimensions.
You know what? Wouldn't it be something if the Apollo scientists, the Wernher von Braun's of years gone back, used this kind of depiction to create the Apollo and the Saturn rocket and exactly what those spaceships looked like?
It would not surprise me at all. In fact, I'm convinced that when FDR sent Nicholas Rurik to Mongolia, to Central Asia, in search of the secrets of the Holy Grail, that what he was actually in search of was this type of ancient technology that we're describing. And by the way, just to tie a knot here between our present and earlier discussion, I'm really proud of Dana Augustine's depiction of the New Atlantis. And again, what he shows at the center of that image is this cone that is emerging from the very center of Atlantis. And that cone is, in fact, this warp craft ascending from the center of Atlantis.
And, of course, Plate 7 will blow your mind after you explain this to people.
I hope you have a real sense of humor here, because you have to get this. What it shows is a comparison of the cross of Atlantis, which again shows a canal entering three concentric rings with a cross in the center. And what we see is that that is exactly the symbol or the stage upon which President Bush stood on August 30th, 2004 at the GOP convention in New York City. He gave his speech while standing in the seal of Atlantis. Now,
look at that.
It's absolutely astonishing, and there's no way that this happened by chance. Karl Rove had to have been sending a message directly to those in the know that America is the New Atlantis, and President Bush is the king of the New Atlantis. In fact, at the end of the speech...
Symbolism.
Unless you can read the language, you're ignorant. And most, unfortunately, most Americans are ignorant of the language of symbolism. That's not a criticism. That's a fact. We just don't know what symbols mean, which means we're uneducated. And we must educate ourselves in the meaning of the symbols that is being used in these propaganda campaigns.
I bet Jordan Maxwell had a field day with this one.
I hope Jordan has seen it. I'll have to get in touch with him and see what he thinks. I wanted to comment on the statement that President Bush used to conclude his speech. Again, he's standing in the seal of Atlantis, which is built up on top of concentric rings. It's an extraordinary scene. And in fact, Karl Rove was asked about this during the preamble to that speech, and his only comment was is that the press was focused on the alleged subliminal crosses that were embedded within the podium that the president was standing in front of. So I don't know about the subliminal crosses, but clearly he's standing in the seal of Atlantis. And at the end of the speech, he says, like generations before us, we have a calling from beyond the stars to stand for freedom. This, he says, is the everlasting dream of America, and tonight, in this place, while he's standing in the seal of Atlantis, that dream is renewed. And in my opinion, what he's saying is that the dream of the New Atlantis is renewed in America today.
Tell me about some of these stargates and some of these portals, William. Is it possible that the Bermuda Triangle might be within where one or two of these may be?
Well, it's possible. Again, we don't have the scientific data that would present a final solution such as that. But what we have is all the incredibly anomalous things that have happened in the Bermuda Triangle. We might more properly call it the Bermuda Vortex. And what we have to do is initiate a thorough study of this phenomena here. You know, both of us, remember, I grew up in the Detroit area. And
as I did. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, these anomalies are reported in the Great Lakes as well. Most people don't realize that there's areas of strong magnetic disturbance in Lake Ontario, for example. And even present-day navigation charts talk about they label 14 areas of magnetic anomalies in Lake Ontario alone, with thousands of ships having disappeared in the Great Lakes over the years.
Same with Lake Superior.
Same with Lake Superior, exactly. So we've got these regions around the planet, and so you know, you follow the story, and lo and behold, what you find around Lake Superior is ancient Michigan legends of Egyptians coming over to the Lake Superior area and hauling out thousands of tons of copper, taking it back to Egypt and other parts. And we just wonder, you know, what is really going on in some of these areas?
Would you relate the story of what you think might be in Iraq with regards to these stargates?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been focusing on that story for a number of years now. We've talked about it off and on in terms of Saddam Hussein's belief that he is the reincarnated biblical king Nebuchadnezzar, whose story recorded in the book of Daniel records the opening of a gateway of some kind through which three wise men entered and returned with one like, or actually the Son of God in tow, depending upon the version of the story that you read. And that's a vital, vital example of a gateway story, because Nebuchadnezzar, in turn, believed that he was the reincarnated biblical king Nimrod. And it was Nimrod who built the Tower of Babel, a word that originally meant gate. He assembled humankind to build the gate to the heavens. But again, the gods said, not so fast. We're not ready for company just now, and they destroyed our tower and separated us by language.
These portals, these stargates, could you accidentally stumble into one and, you know, like a Twilight Zone movie, be in another dimension? Or do you have to get into it with some different kinds of consciousness?
Well, certainly I would prefer to enter it through the right and proper consciousness. I haven't come across any stories of people stumbling into them. Alice in Wonderland is of course, a fictional take on that very concept right there.
That's a good point.
You're but, right. I think it has to be, a person has to be a highly advanced consciousness before they can perceive or, in fact, begin to travel these gateways. And again, you know, there's what we're assembling today through various disciplines is the means by which we can transform ourselves, reclaim that divine essence within ourselves, which is our birthright, and become stargate travelers or time travelers.
Some people believe that America is the new Atlantis. What's your take?
Well, I mean, that's a phenomenal concept. It goes back to Sir Francis Bacon, who published a book. Well, actually, the book was published in 1627, the year after he died. The book was called The New Atlantis, and it prophesied the emergence of a technologically and spiritually advanced civilization in America that would have as its center a pillar or column of light, which I think is the same as this particle accelerator that we've been describing.
The New Atlantis was prophesized 1600s?
1627, that's right.
The thought of this, does it mean that they think we're going to sink as well?
Well, the prophecy of the New Atlantis is more about ascension that it is a cataclysm of some kind. It's about reclaiming this divine greatness, and that's why it's the ultimate story, because it's the ultimate carrot, really, that's in front of all of us, that if we can achieve this, we're going to be a transformed species. And throughout American history, we've had figures such as Thomas Jefferson who have been involved in this mystery. It's claimed that Jefferson actually possessed missing chapters of Bacon's New Atlantis, and that these works are hidden or concealed within the cornerstone of the U.S. Capitol, for example. So it's one of these ideas that always represents the ideal. It represents something that we may or may not be able to achieve, but the point is we have to pursue it.
How much of your work in research deals with extraterrestrial life or visitation?
Well, I'm constantly encountering it. It's one of the primary lenses through which I view myth and scripture. I mean, I certainly believe in many different forms of other dimensional beings. You have the literal physical beings, then you have the more etheric types. And so it's a constant within my research.
So it doesn't stop.
It does not stop. No, absolutely not. And, you know, what an exciting time to be doing this kind of research as well, because for the first time in a couple of thousand years, some of the key texts are finally available to us. Those I referenced earlier, the Hypostasis of the Archons that I wrote about in Oracle of the Illuminati. I mean, it clearly spells out, according to the first Christians, here is the deal. You have come to this planet. You don't belong here. You have a divine particle within you. There's this extraterrestrial race out here called the Archons, or rulers, that have what you want. and they're going to do just about anything they can to get it from you, including setting up a material world that will be a world of distraction to your soul that will keep you off your true spiritual purpose. And so when you start with stories like that, you have to incorporate the extraterrestrial perspective. Otherwise, none of this really makes any sense.
You do not believe they're benevolent creatures?
Well, no. I think that there are those that are benevolent, but there are certainly others that are in competition with us that would like to take, again, that divine particle from within us.
Basically, that's almost the theory of David Jacobs, who believes that these aren't nice entities.
Well, yeah, again, I'm not familiar with his work, but he would most certainly benefit from reading The Hypostasis of the Archons.
Of everything that you've done now, William, you and I, we've talked over the last 4 years. Man, it's going to be five in April, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
That's how fast time flies. Well, in your research, what one thing still baffles you? There's got to be something.
The ultimate question to me is still, what is the human body? I mean, we completely take for granted this flesh and blood vehicle that our soul is transported in. And what baffles me is why aren't we taught the spiritual capabilities of our bodies? Why is the human body so suppressed? Why can't we talk about the excretions and the secretions of the human body in public? You know, those seven dirty words that you can't say on radio or television all refer to the excretions of the body. And I believe it's because ultimately there is a conspiracy, literally, to withhold the knowledge of the sacred secretions our body is capable of creating. That if we could learn how to harness the power of this body and move this spiritual energy through it, it would release secretions from our pineal gland that contain all the secrets of the universe. And this would cause the virtual instant transmutation of our species if we were raised from the time we're young to know that our body is in fact the stairway to heaven of myth and scripture.
You are a believer in the afterlife, I believe, right?
Yes.
Always have been?
Well, I suppose so. I believe in reincarnation, although I'm not sure of any of my past lives. It's just an inner knowing that I have. And I certainly believe in the afterlife. I mean, especially when you consider, you know, the way our consciousness is expanding today and our connection to not just other solar systems within our galaxy, but other galaxies within the universe. I mean, it's to me without question that there are passageways linking the universe and that our soul's ultimate quest here on Earth is to claim that ring or vibration of cosmic sovereignty that the gods wish for us to have, so that we can enjoy the afterlife traveling the magnificent universe that we're all a part of.
We're going to open up the phone lines next hour, William. I can't believe we're racing into hour number three with you. Your website, williamhenry.net. Any recommendations to people when they go to the site?
Check out the I have an article up on the Stargate of Atlantis. And I'd encourage anybody who's interested in the story to get a copy of my Stargate 2012 DVD or Stargates of the Gods DVD, because it's got a lot of this imagery as well as my my lecture presentation on this subject.
All right. William Henry has been our guest. And what are you working on next, William?
Well, I've got a couple of things I'm working on. I'm actually going to be finishing up this book on Atlantis next year, which is going to be finished once I get some additional research done in Egypt in March, again, with going with Freddie Silva.
Right.
And then getting some additional data on cosmic rays emanating from the center of the galaxy, and that'll represent the second half of this Atlantis discussion. And I've also got a book coming out in November called The Illuminator, which is about the myths and mysteries of Mary Magdalene.
That'll be interesting, too. We'll stay with us. We'll open up the phone lines. Our special guest tonight is William Henry. Now, and welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, William Henry. William, when you go to Egypt, which will be what, your second trip?
Yes.
Ah. Now, what are you going to look for specifically?
Well, I've got more research to follow up on. I've been in contact with a recent Coast guest, Stephen Mailer. who has a really interesting body of research that he's putting together concerning this this particular hieroglyph called the Asgot-Nefer glyph, which means the harmony of water or beautiful waters. And you remember a moment ago when you asked about that that the possibility that the drawing that Sitchin presented is actually some kind of a weapon system, and I said,
yes.
No, it's probably an ascension vehicle because of the pillar that's portrayed underground. Well, that pillar appears to be connected with the creation of these spiritual-type waters, and so I'm very interested in that subject right now. Because, of course, you know, there's a real Atlantean tie-in with the whole idea of the waters, of it being called the land of waters, and always looking for the myths and legends of those who work with this water, who cross this water, as did Elijah and Enoch, who of civilizations that are destroyed by water, because that that whole concept of water, especially spiritual water, is virtually unexplored right now.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Let's pick it up by going to first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with William Henry. Hi there.
Hello, George and
yes,
William.
Sir.
My name's Charlie. I'm calling from Houston.
Mm.
A few moments ago, you were talking about the possibility of the Bermuda Triangle being a vortex. And I was
yes.
just wondering, if it were a vortex, could there also be other vortexes around the Earth, possibly opposite each other on the surface of the Earth? I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay.
It's certainly a possibility. I mean, as we discussed, there's at least one other major vortex area in the Great Lakes region, and so undoubtedly there's going to be others, but I haven't seen a map of where all the various planetary vortexes are located, although that would be an interesting task for somebody to assemble.
Another one for you, William, would be to investigate Coral Castle.
Well, I've touched on that. I was really excited by Richard Hoagland's investigation into that. And I got a small library of Edley Scallon's books and started pouring through them. And the reason I was intrigued is because the imagery that he uses in his books, it's wormhole imagery. And it suggests that he, too, might have been clued into this this same primordial sacred science that we've been discussing this evening. So that's definitely something to follow up on. I'm planning a trip to Florida in January to investigate. I've got good friends down in the Naples-Fort Myers area, and I'm hoping to pop back down there and head over to Coral Castle at the same time.
Well, wouldn't it be something, though, if the secrets to all of this happens to be right under our nose? It's that easy?
Well, I mean, it appears that that's the case, and there are people that have a tendency to tap into it. And then the object is to learn how to embody that and put it into practical application, and that's where we're at right now.
All right, we'll pick it up by going to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, is this for me?
Yes, sir. You've got it.
Okay, this is Floyd. I'm calling you from San Antonio, Texas. You know, it's WOAI land.
Absolutely. Number one WOAI land. Go ahead.
Exactly. Well, to show you what a William Henry fan I am, I'm going to ask William to give us maybe 2 or 3 minutes of, I guess, what you'd call comic relief and have him tell again, like he did about 6 years ago on Coast to Coast, briefly the story of the one-footed snorkel monster.
Oh, boy, this is like a greatest hit show now.
What a memory.
No kidding.
Well, yeah, I recorded it for the first time about 6 years ago. I've played it probably 50 times since then.
Oh, incredible. Well, I guess I'd like to hear your version of the story then. No, I'm just kidding. This is an amazing story, George. It happened here in Tennessee, a little town called Cross Plains, Tennessee.
All right.
Of all place names, where the plains or fields cross. And what happened is there's a gentleman, I call him Larry Bird in the story just to protect his real name. He's awakened one night by what sounds like rain falling down on the roof of his trailer. And I know it sounds, you know, like a story because we're talking Tennessee and everybody thinks trailer parks, but this guy is literally awakened by, and there is a police report on this as well, the rain falls down on the roof of his trailer. He awakens. He looks outside, and he sees what he describes as a one-footed snorkel monster on his deck. This thing looks like an elephant's trunk, but it has a single bird's foot, and it's being fired upon by a UFO, he says, that was hovering just above a radio tower about a mile or two away.
What?
Yeah, and he describes this thing to the local TV and newspaper people as the one-footed snorkel monster, because that's what it looked like. And he said he got the sense the thing had been wounded, his dog had been fired upon by a laser beam shot from this UFO, and his dog was injured, trees were knocked down in his backyard, and his family, he woke them up because he was terrified, for one thing, for their safety, but he also wanted them to see what he was seeing so that when he told them about it later, they wouldn't think he was crazy. And so he watches this scenario unfold all night long. They wake up the next morning, and all appears to be calm. And his wife has a daylight sighting of this one-footed snorkel monster. She looks across the street and sees that the thing is spinning in place. The night before, they had seen it spin and turn into a ball of light that danced around his truck, underneath the truck, dancing throughout the yard. And how I got tipped onto this story is Larry Bird called my brother-in-law's brother and said, "You are not going to believe what happened to me, and your brother is the weirdest person I know. I need to talk with him." And he was being nice when he's calling him a weird person. He just needs someone that would understand what he was going through. And so my sister and brother-in-law took off immediately, went up there, and aided the family, gave them comfort, and also developed a tremendous sense of compassion for this being.
So they believed the story.
Oh, absolutely. Uh-huh. And in fact, my brother-in-law, Donnie, took a photograph of this thing's footprint. And I have that in my archives. And I'll put that article back up on my website. I took it down when I was...
How big was the print?
The print was about 3 inches. It was bigger than a chicken's footprint. But here's the thing, George. When you look throughout myth and in even scripture, you find example after example of creatures that match the one-footed snorkel monster. But the thing is that it is so arcane in these stories. They describe these serpents, which they call the serpents of wisdom, but they very often omit or conceal the detail that it has a single bird's foot. And so here we have in this amazing story from Cross Plains, Tennessee, what appears to be an appearance of this creature that appears throughout the ages. I'll give you an example. In ancient Egypt, in the Edfu text, they describe this one-footed snorkel monster-type creature, a one-footed serpent that is attacked by the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid sends out a sound wave in order to attack or repel this creature. It's absolutely amazing, amazing tales that are told around this creature.
How does this thing balance itself?
I have no idea. But what I'm thinking, it's just some kind of an anomalous creature. And as my research developed on it, I began to wonder when you see it in alchemical texts where they'll show, for example, a jar or some form of a grail with this serpent figure emerging from it. And we actually will see human beings that are entering into or exiting from this serpent creature, this snorkel monster. And as I began to accumulate a repetition of this imagery, I began to wonder, is this creature like some kind of a wormhole itself? Is this why it's tube-shaped in this way? And why we see human beings entering into and exiting from it? It's not consuming them as if it's eating humans for food. Rather, it appears to function as some form of a conduit.
Who named it a one-footed snorkel monster?
Gentleman I call Larry Bird.
He did. Okay. Not
it.
You.
No, not me. He didn't know what it was, so he just called it a one-footed snorkel monster because it had one bird's foot and it looked like an elephant's trunk, but it was green.
I would like to see this picture. This illustration.
I'll send it to you. Be happy to do that. And I'll send you the police report, too.
Send it to Lex, too. Maybe you can post it in his recap with you.
Great idea. I'll do that.
All right. Let's go next to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, Mr. Norrie.
Yes, sir. Hi.
Hi. My name's Chris. I'm from Tucson, Arizona.
Hello, Chris. It's all yours. Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Henry. Hi. Hi. I just wanted to ask you two quick things. What's your thought of the parallel universe and paradoxes in relation to time travel? And if you don't mind, before you get to that, Mr. Norrie,
yeah.
About 2 months ago, you had a gentleman on the show that you're doing some kind of ESP thing. I guess he was in Virginia and you were in your station, and I guess you thought of a pyramid and you thought of a house. I thought of a house too.
Yeah, that was I think that was Lionel Fanthorpe.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'll go ahead and let Mr. Henry take the question.
Okay.
And
very
I'll
good.
Get off there and I'll listen to it.
William, what do you think of parallel universes and time travel?
Well, I think it's really possible, and while we're on the greatest hits subject here, I remember we were talking a few years ago about my book, Cloak of the Illuminati, and I was describing the new nanotechnology super soldier suit that's being created by MIT for the military, and how Dana Augustine had, when he was doing the artwork for the cover of that book, said, wow, this capability of this suit that has a charge in its heel where the soldier can jump over a house if he needs to, that sounds like Spring-Heeled Jack. And I had no idea who Spring-Heeled Jack was, but you might remember we had talked about that. And this is a story from England where this figure had this suit that he wore that made him he was resistant to ballistic attack. He couldn't, if he was shot, the bullet pinged off, and he could jump over houses. And I mentioned that.
And he had like a hook or something for hands.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the last appearance of Spring-Heeled Jack was in London, and he gathered a bunch of people to a house, and he disappeared over the house, and the name of the street was William Henry Street.
I love it.
Yeah. And I just always say, well, yeah, I wonder if, you know, that's like a time traveler that suddenly led me to this street here and saying, okay, you're on the right track. Keep pursuing this suit. Because as you look into these stories of the beings that come and go through these gateways, there is always a power garment that they are wearing preparatory to that experience. And here's a classic example of that garment, or an initial step towards the creation of this super suit that transforms an ordinary human into a superhuman.
Do evil creatures, entities, call them what you may, come through these portals, these stargates? Have they ever hurt somebody physically?
I don't have any data on that, George. My sense is that, again, from the examples that I've been studying, it requires a ring or a vibration, as I described it earlier, as the ring of cosmic sovereignty. That's pure love. That is pure love, is what is required. And it suggests to me that a being of evil is going to be a fear-based being and therefore would not be able to access these portals.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Good evening.
Yeah.
George and William.
We are here for you.
Thank you. This is Mike. I'm calling in Strongsville, Ohio tonight with my friend.
Sure.
William, since you mentioned the pituitary gland's excretions revealing possible secret knowledge, that spot between our eyes, marked with a red dot in India, sometimes referred as our point of existence, interesting test. Dr. Strassman, he was the only person allowed to do a clinical study that compound DMT, which is naturally occurring from our pituitary gland. And Dr. Strassman said that volunteers on the highest doses reported meeting and communicating with extraterrestrial entities. And could this be a possible mechanism for change in mass consciousness via either the sun's activity or Paul of Violet's cosmic wave?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a very great question, Mike, because it suggests that we have this mechanism built within that is capable of receiving, through a process of resonance, very tiny electromagnetic frequencies that can, in fact, release these secretions. And that's the whole shooting match for me right there, is finding the way to open up that oyster, because it transforms us into a being of tremendous spiritual capability, and also ultimately a being of ultimate love. And that's what this is all about.
I'm still trying to find out more information on this one-footed snorkel monster you talked about. You ever mention that critter at your speaking engagements?
I have, yes. And it's a favorite of many of the people in my audiences. And in fact, there is more to the story, I've been told, by Larry Bird. And perhaps now is the time to reconnect with him to get the second half. He was not wanting to reveal additional facts about what happened that night, just because he was concerned that nobody would believe him. I mean, we're talking about a ordinary type of a person here that is not interested in these subjects, that found himself witness to this astonishing display of, a cosmic encounter. Just amazing.
Could this have been Mothman?
You know what, George? I can't believe you said that, because I don't usually go to psychics, but I did have an opportunity to get a reading once several years ago, shortly after working on this story, and he said, "Your research is directly related to Mothman." And I'm like, "What are you talking about? My research has nothing to do with Mothman." And it turns out that it does. That there is this connection between Mothman and the snorkel monster, and that's something I'm still having to kind of follow up on, and I'll be happy to report on it as soon as I've got some additional data.
Apparently, Mothman always shows up before major Earth-wide calamities or catastrophes, and I find that alone to be pretty fascinating. You know, comes before wars, comes before disasters. I don't know if he is a warning device, it is a warning device, or if it helps cause some of them. I just don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But the snorkel monster had the feeling, according to Larry Bird, of being, it was being pursued by who was operating the UFO hovering above the radio tower, and he had a sense that it had escaped from some kind of an extraterrestrial zoo or something.
Probably one of those Star Wars bars.
Maybe.
You never know. Well, stay with us. William Henry, our guest, his website, williamhenry.net. We'll finish up the program by taking the rest of your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Well, I'm getting a lot of fast blasts from people who want to know a little bit more about the Stargate tours in Nashville.
Oh, cool.
What is that?
Well, the drawing that we looked at of the second century particle accelerator,
right?
That came out of my research that I had done on FDR's quest for the Holy Grail in Mongolia in 1934. He, along with his two-term Secretary of Agriculture, Henry A. Wallace, and Nicholas Rurik, a Russian mystic, reformed the archetypal trio of the three wise men looking for the reincarnated Jesus as well as the secrets of the Holy Grail. There was a series of letters that were written by Henry Wallace to Nicholas Rurik during the course of that expedition and the preamble to it. One of those letters clearly indicated that they were searching for the Holy Grail without question, but it also gave some coordinates. And the coordinates that he gave in the letter referred to the place where they were going to return these secrets. The place was Nashville, Tennessee. And what I found as I was looking around Nashville for any kind of evidence that the results of this quest may have turned up in Nashville led me to a place called the Tennessee Bicentennial Capitol Mall, which is a 2,200-foot-long rod, magician's rod, that is laid out on 19 acres, maybe even 19.5 acres. Hi, Richard. At the base of the Tennessee State Capitol. This magician's rod is a virtual carbon copy of the second century particle accelerator drawing.
So the quest for this, the drawing that you've shown us that
yes.
we have on the website,
mm-hmm.
Was an illustration. However, it was based on something real then, right?
Yes, I believe it was. And what we have here in Nashville now is a living temple that is this rod laid out on the ground. If you go to my website, I have a link on the front page called Stargate Park. And I have a side-by-side, a comparison of the second century Meru drawing with a line drawing of the Bicentennial Capitol Mall. And we can see that we are talking about the same type of technology.
All right, let's go to the phones.
Okay.
First time caller line, you're on the air with William Henry on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hello, Mr. Henry. This is Ed. I'm in Los Angeles.
Hello, Ed.
A few minutes ago, I tuned into the show late, and I believe I heard Mr. Henry saying that he wished we could understand the human body well enough to know how to direct its energies so that we could activate the pineal gland and come into this great gift of cosmic consciousness. If I did understand you correctly, sir, I just wanted to make sure you understood that these techniques, insofar as they are meditative and meditational, have been known for thousands of years, even though they are not broadcast like through a newspaper or a radio show. They are found in the occult study of the Kabbalah, the secret wisdom of Israel. My teachers tell me that we can trace the Kabbalah back through history more than 5,000 years. Basically, the techniques are meditative, and they raise the kundalini up one stage at a time into the brain, and when it activates the pineal gland, the granular material there crystallizes into what is otherwise known as the philosopher's stone. And it is then that organ provides us with access to a sensibility without restriction and limitation, a wholeness and a universality within ourselves, and a union with the universe and God.
Well spoken, Ed. In fact, during our first hour, George and I were talking about some Templar graffiti at Dom, France, that portrayed exactly the Sephirotic Tree of Life, the Kabbalistic tree, and indicates that the Templars likely were using these principles at that time in the 13th century. And I cited that as one clear example of this group accessing this knowledge. And you're absolutely right. This knowledge is known, but it is not widely taught. It's the type of thing that when the student is ready, the teachers appear. And perhaps now is becoming a time when more and more students are going to be ready, and here come the teachers.
Thanks for that question. Thanks for the response also, William. East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good evening. My question is, why do you suppose that entities who are so advanced and powerful and operating so openly in ancient times, even after the fall of Atlantis, would then suddenly sort of cut humanity off from knowledge of their existence at a certain point and leave us, you know, in rational materialism or sort of, you know, watered down versions of Shinarian religion and sort of leave us groping? You know, what do you suppose that seems to have happened?
Well, I think getting back to our earlier discussion about our relationship with the galactic center, you know, various traditions talk about the 26,000-year cosmic journey called the precession of the equinoxes that our sun and solar system make around the galactic center. And it appears that, according to these various traditions, we go through intermittent periods of light and darkness. It's the modus operandi of the gods is build it to destroy it to build it again. And that seems to be the cyclic nature of all of nature, and it's a perfectly natural process. And right now, we happen to be in one of the heightened stages of that process, where we're beginning to experience climate change, consciousness change, and this is, as I referred to earlier, right, the golden moment when we have an opportunity to really embrace an age of light and emerge from the darkness.
Okay, well, thank you. I thought he was going to come back with his follow-up question, and he said nothing. Let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn. You're on with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, William.
Hello to you.
I am calling from near Nashville, from Murfreesboro, William.
Oh, very nice.
And I just have to thank you, and I am deeply grateful for the knowledge that you are sharing with all of us, and it is obvious to me that you are coming from a place of genuine and sincere love, and that just really permeates through everything you say.
Well, thank you very much.
So a couple of questions. One is you seem to have a lot of knowledge about the meaning of names of things or words. Where are you getting that knowledge is the first question.
Oh, well, it's a constant search. I mean, I try to zero in on certain key words, Atlantis, Tula, Meru, and look for their repetition throughout the ages, and just spend my time trying to accumulate the meanings of these words in various cultures.
Okay. And then the second question is, do you believe that Jesus had some type of an extraterrestrial connection?
Well, I think without question, especially we've referenced the hypostasis of the archons this evening. I've got my new book, The Illuminator, coming out about Mary Magdalene, and that is the entire premise of the Gnostic Christian tradition, is that he was in contact with other beings and, in fact, taught various disciples how to communicate with them. That's one of the primary principles of the Gnostic Christian tradition, is that there are these beings, you can learn their language, you can learn the secrets of the heavens. In fact, that is a large part of our earthly existence, is to accumulate such knowledge. So to answer your question directly, yes, I do believe that he was in direct contact with these beings. And, of course, the traditional Christian church focuses on his encounter with one being in particular, which they call Satan, who is presented as a tempter in the traditional Christian tradition, but may have another role to play as an enlightener type being called Lucifer in other traditions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you too. You know, the conflict between good and evil, and Satan and Jesus has always fascinated me. I'm wondering, though, if there's a bigger picture to that, William, that we really haven't been taught yet or pointed out. I mean, there just seems to be a relationship, a closeness between this good and evil that I find strange.
Oh, without question, George. And that's, again, one of the opportunities of our times, I feel. You know, in the past, we talk about Satan taking Jesus up to the high mountain and tempting him, saying, hey, this can all be yours. And we're asked to consider that where he took him to was the pinnacle of Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. Well, what if instead he took him up to the Hubble Space Telescope and downloaded a couple images and said, look, all of this can be yours. All the hundreds of billions of galaxies that are out there, isn't that in fact the kingdom that we're really talking about? And that is what brings about the awakening to me, is taking our position, our perspective, away from a dot of real estate on Earth and saying what we really want to focus on and tune our consciousness into is the greater universe out there, the enormous garden of galaxies that we now know is our natural habitat.
Next up is our wild card line. It's your turn. Hi there.
George, is that me?
Yes, sir. Hi.
Fantastic. Good to talk to both of you. I'm really honored. I wanted to say, first of all, to William Henry, in my search for my own truth, I inadvertently stumbled across the language of the birds, and my eyes have been really open ever since.
Good for you.
Remarkable thing. William, I'd like to ask, on your last show, I think it was, you asked about, or you talked about an image that a Napoleon, one of his savants, made a rubbing of a bas relief in Egypt of,
yes.
I think you called it the Mandelion?
Yes.
What was that figure known as in Egypt? What was the name in that place?
The name of that figure in Egypt was Serapis, who was a combined god, a combination of Osiris and Api, which was a bull god, who was featured as a serpent, and the image to which the gentleman refers was a rubbing made in 1798 by a savant in Napoleon's army that shows the exact face on the face of the Shroud of Turin only it's on the body of a serpent. And the kind of amazing thing about it is that this rubbing was made 100 years before the first photograph was made of the Shroud of Turin, revealing the Holy Face to the world, allegedly for the first time. And what this shows is that there are, in fact, two examples of this exact face, one on the Shroud of Turin, one on this rubbing made by Napoleon's, the savant Napoleon's army that is today in the Louvre.
Oh, great. Thank you. I've been waiting for months to ask you that. And also, I was watching on one of the TV learning channels. I'm sorry, I don't remember which one, but they showed a picture of another drawing or possibly a bas relief in Egypt. It looked just like Alfred E. Newman from Mad Magazine. Do you have any idea what that is?
No idea, but I show in my presentations from other temple sites. Remember the worms from Men in Black?
Uh-huh.
You see them on the temple walls, too. You see these reptilian guys that look, they're exactly like the worms. I mean, the guys from Men in Black must have seen these guys on the temple walls in Egypt. They're hilarious.
All right. Well, that's enough for my mind tonight. I sure appreciate both of you for what you do. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you for your call. What do you think of the etching on that plaque, whatever it might be, from Abydos, Egypt, that looks like a helicopter and ships and flying machines?
Well, I've been told that that's actually a mistake. The explanation for that is that they had done some repairs on some of the hieroglyphs there, and it only looks or appears like it's a helicopter, but in fact, I guess it's really not. But when you go there and you actually look at it, it sure does look like a helicopter. So the jury's still kind of out on that one, I think.
Let's pop west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, William.
Hi there.
Great to be on tonight. I'm Bill from Washington State, listening on 1470 KELA.
Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I love your show. I listen often. My question tonight, because I'm Cherokee descent, is, what was the name of the book that you mentioned earlier on? I didn't quite catch it. And the Cherokee woman that you spoke of, could you spell her name?
Certainly. The title of the book is Voices of Our Ancestors. The author's name is Dhyani Wehu, and I'll spell that. It's Dhyani Wehu, Y-W-A-H-O-O.
Give us another recap of the book, will you?
Well, this is Cherokee teachings that she has assimilated or brought together that go back 27 generations. And she is a member of the traditional Etowah band of the Cherokee, which has lived in Georgia and East Tennessee over here. And she was trained from the time she was very young in the ancestral wisdom of her lineage, and then later was charged with the duty to put this in a book and bring these teachings forward that, again, had been secret until 1969, coincidentally the same year we landed on the moon.
Wow, that's great. Thank you very much. Can you tell us a little bit more about this 12th gate of energy?
Well, these 12 gates of energy are really interesting because Plato had said that if you could see the true Earth from afar, it would appear as a 12-angled pyramid. Then the Egyptians also had this idea, only they said that at each of the apexes of the 12 points are holes in space that are guarded by some kind of a serpent. And what I've been wondering is if we're talking about some kind of a natural energy gateway that surrounds our planet, and if in fact these are the gates that are referred to as the 12 gates of the New Jerusalem, for example. Interestingly, science has come up with the notion that the universe itself is roughly shaped like a 12-angled pyramid or a dodecahedron. So it appears that this is some very important sacred geometry that we have to more fully understand.
Okay, thanks for that question. Let's move on next to our wildcard line real quickly. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Marcy. I'm calling from Troy, New York.
Sure thing, Marcy.
I got a few questions real quick. One, I hear you guys mentioning a lot about the Philosopher's Stone. I was wondering what exactly that is. Two, What was the first evidence as far as Atlantis that they were of a higher, that they were, you know, highly technology and all that? And three, this super suit you were mentioning before, what was that about?
And I'll let you knock them out in 30 seconds, William. The Philosopher's Stone.
Is removing the interval, the lag time between thought and action so that you have instant materialization of wishes. And the idea that Atlantis has left us an advanced technology comes from many traditions. I mean, just look at the Great Pyramids as one example of a hypothesis of advanced Atlantean technology. And you look at the Osirian, which is beside the Temple of Abydos, where you referred the helicopter as being located. These ancient temples were devised by beings that had machinery and milling capabilities that we're scarcely matching today. And that's a key example right there, especially the Osirian, of ancient temple complexes that embody this and portray this in imagery.
All right, William. Let's go to williamhenry.net. Thanks, William. Appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you so much, George. I really appreciate the conversation.